You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a scientist who says scientists need to do a better job of communicating their ideas to the public. Now, if you've been following the ongoing debate over immigration in the United States, you've probably heard the term chain migration come up. The term itself is controversial. It usually refers to family-based preferences for immigrants. President Trump has called for an end to the program. He says it leads to one immigrant bringing many more people into the U.S., and he says some of the people who enter the country this way could pose a national security risk. Those in favor of family-based immigration say it's a long-standing legal method to live in the United States and keep families together, and immigrants brought over with family preferences still go through a years-long immigration process. Elise Cohen is an assistant professor of political science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc. Elise, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
Can you talk about how this system works, these family-based preferences for immigration that some people are calling chain migration?
Yeah, so basically we have four major principles that currently shape our U.S. policy on legal permanent immigration. The first one, as you mentioned, is this family reunification principle. And so that is the largest category. It's been in place really as the guiding principle of our visa program since 1965. Beyond that, we also do have a skills-based subset. And, of course, we offer some protection on a humanitarian basis to refugees. The final category, the smallest one, is that diversity of admissions by country of origin, what's come to be known popularly as the diversity visa lottery. But this chain migration term has been used by demographers describing this process where people are more likely to move to places that they already know someone, where they already have family. So it sort of makes sense from their perspective. These migration flows will go to certain locales, certain destinations where we see people of similar origins and their family members migrate. What we see now is a more politicized usage of chain migration to give kind of a negative framing to this idea that we really shouldn't have this program, that we should be more restrictive of legal immigration to the U.S. And that's where you hear President Donald Trump and some of those supporters, and actually going back to the 80s and even the 90s, some groups that really favor restrictive immigration policy, even back then starting to kind of use this term chain migration with that negative connotation.
I want to give a listen to President Trump speaking during the State of the Union address. He called for the end of, he used the phrase chain migration. Here's a listen.
Under the current broken system, a single immigrant can bring in virtually unlimited numbers of distant relatives. Under our plan, we focus on the immediate family by limiting sponsorships to spouses and minor children.
So, Elise, let's talk about the virtually unlimited numbers of distant relatives. In practice, does family preference migration, chain migration, work that way?
Well, there's a little bit of a partial truth in saying unlimited distant relatives. So green card holders, what we call the lawful permanent residents, they can petition to bring in their spouses and their unmarried children. U.S. citizens can bring in their parents, their married adult children, and their adult siblings. So that's really what we're talking about. This kind of claim that all distant relatives can be brought in is circulating, but it's not exactly accurate because neither citizens nor lawful permanent residents can bring in aunts or uncles or cousins or nieces or nephews, in-laws, you know, grandparents. So I think it's a bit more specific than what that quote would lead people to believe. Another thing to keep in mind, you know, for the popularity of it at the moment is kind of thinking about even where we are in Wisconsin. We had a lot of German concentrations, and this is due to the fact that, I guess, if we were going to use chain migration, we had, you know, chain migration shaping our history as a country. And so that's why we even had sort of all German-speaking towns early in our Wisconsin state history as a result of what he would call chain migration and his supporters, and what others have popularly known as the term family reunification.
Elise Cohen is with us, assistant professor of political science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc, talking about family reunification, immigration, called chain migration by some. We're figuring out how it works. Elise, when someone comes into the country under this program, what kind of steps do they go through?
So they have to first petition in order to have these, immediate relatives, or if it's something like for a U.S. citizen, the married adult children or the adult sibling. And so there will be a rather lengthy waiting process. We also have to keep in mind that the U.S. citizens are those that can bring in more of those relatives. And to become a U.S. citizen, to naturalize, you have to go through a five-year residency and lots of other hoops in order to naturalize. So there's a process there. It's not sort of this immediate chain reaction, pun intended, where someone would be able to legally immigrate and just right away bring in all of these relatives. So for people that are, for example, bringing in relatives from a country like Mexico or the Philippines, there could be, 25-year waiting period for some of those relatives to be able to get their visa to come.
And the idea, the concern about chain migration, bringing in distant relatives, I think is, okay, if this person brings in their kids and this person brings in their siblings and then the sibling brings in somebody and so on, this chain can keep spreading and spreading. But what you're saying is it can be upwards of 20 years to bring the next person in.
Yes, because we use caps based on countries. It's a very complex immigration policy system we have, because we have that family reunification, but then within that, we have preferences where we will first give preference to U.S. citizens bringing their immediate, truly immediate relatives. We will then give preferences, to the other categories bringing in immediate versus, adult siblings or married adult children. And then that's just one of those four that I told you initially kind of structures our policy. I think that makes it vulnerable to exploitation, for political purposes, because it is really hard for an ordinary American to understand all of these categories, let alone the per country cap that we have in place, so that if it is a high volume country where we have a lot of visas that have been given, like Mexico or the Philippines or China or India, yeah, you're right, the waiting period could be over 20 years.
There's been a lot of talk in recent years about dealing with illegal immigration and cutting the numbers of undocumented immigrants in the country. There's now a turn, it seems, to talk about the currently legal forms of immigration, like this family reunification. Why do you think that has changed?
Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of my research focuses on this concept called nativism. It's sort of a defensive nationalism where it can be internal minority groups present in the country already, but it's often especially targeting foreigners or immigrants. And we have a long history of that in our country, and we have a lot of what we call nativist waves that become popular at different moments in our sort of collective history and politics. I think we've always had these two faces going back to our founding as a political system of, on one hand, having this sort of almost instinct to be restrictive and exclusive about who can really be an American, and at the same time having this idea of being an American creed where anyone can be welcome here if they believe in our Constitution and democracy and principles of freedom and liberty. So we really have always had these sort of two faces, the nativist tendencies that we've seen with different very restrictive policies targeting different groups based on their ethnic origins, for example, or their race or religion. And at the same time, a segment of Americans that really kind of embrace that you can come from anywhere in the world and then become American by believing in these American values and ideas. So right now, I think what we're seeing is, sorry, didn't mean to cut you off, a bit of that one of those nativist waves has taken hold in our politics.
We'll leave it there for now, Elise, but maybe we can talk the history a little more in a future show. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rob.
That's Elise Cohen, assistant professor of political science at UW-Sheboygan and UW-Manitowoc. She joined us to talk about family reunification migration or chain migration and the political fight over it. By some estimates, only 10 people on average read any given scientific article in an academic journal. If you've ever read one, you might know why. Pages and pages of academic jargon are written for academics. Our next guest says scientists need to do a better job of getting that info out to the public in a more accessible way. Esther Gumby is a postdoctoral fellow at Auburn University who's written about making science accessible. Esther, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, we just mentioned the statistic, only about 10 people read a given academic article. Does that fit in with your experience in writing and reading scientific journal articles?
Yes, I would say most of the time, yes. A lot of us scientists, we actually, even amongst ourselves, we don't read a manuscript or a journal paper in its entirety. We take a look at the abstract and we go into the introduction, and if it's too long, we just like give up. Unless, you know, as a scientist too, some of the articles, we will read them to its entirety just because we have to cite them, we have to use them to form our next set of questions for our research work. So it really depends on what article and how engaging that writer or author is.
Now, that's for other scientists, but you're worried about the rest of us, the non-science audience. For somebody coming from the outside, coming into these journal articles, is it going to be hard for us to see what's going on?
Oh, definitely, yes. Definitely, yes. And that's a big problem that we, the scientists, have. And I believe that we are finally working on it, because we tend to write these articles using very technical language, language that you and I and any common person would not understand. And so if I'm just an ordinary person who wants to find out what's going on, and as soon as I get that abstract that's full of technical language, obviously you lose me. And once you lose me, then there's no way I'm going to read it. So yes, a lot of normal people and public don't eventually even read anything that's out there. And secondly, too, most of these articles that we publish are only accessible if you subscribe to them. And so that's something that we also, as scientists, need to go through. And most of them, you can only access them through the university networks. And of course, the regular person would not be able to access it.
So if the public isn't in touch with what scientists are doing, what's the problem? What do we lose if we're not having that communication?
First of all, we are not finally putting the science to use. And as a scientist, I know a lot of the questions that we are asking and all the research we are doing, the end point of it is to help tackle or solve some of the today's problems. For example, food security issues, climate change. These are issues that we are addressing and our research is working very hard to do. And so if we are not eventually communicating to the public, we are losing that final impact of what we, the scientists, do. And we are finally losing that final impact of what science should do, because science should be the thing that's helping solve today's challenges. So that's what we scientists lose. We are not being out there, we are not actively solving, and we are not getting our research to the public, you know, to the policymakers who are also using all these results to translate them into policy and wider solutions that are able to affect a bigger population.
And you're hoping for a couple of solutions. One is to kind of change the incentives. Right now, if you're a scientist, especially at a university, you're expected to publish in these academic journals. What would you like to see change when it comes to what scientists are rewarded for doing?
So, and one of the bigger problems, actually, and why we scientists don't end up, you know, sharing our work is actually the way we are rewarded in the universities. So you all know that it's all about publish or perish. So as a scientist, how I'm rewarded, especially with tenure system, I'll be rewarded just by the number of articles that are published. And once they're published, nobody really cares how impactful they were. And so I think if the university steps back and kind of applauds the scientists that take the science further, you know, if, for instance, like right now, I do write opinion pieces, I do write commentaries on regular media outlets. So if at the end of the year, I'm able to say, hey, you know, apart from publishing one or two scientific papers, I was able to publish three or four opinion pieces, which ended up reaching, let's say, a million people. So that should also be used as a metric to judge me as a scientist. And I think that's something that universities need to really work on.
We're talking to Esther Gumby. She is a postdoctoral fellow at Auburn University. She says scientists need to do more to communicate to the public in ways that the public can understand. And Esther, what do you want to see from your colleagues in the science world? What do you want to see them try to do?
So first of all, I say I want to see scientists really taking their science to the public. And how do we do that? First of all, after we publish a scientific article, we ought to take it further and publish either an opinion piece or commentaries, or go to the media and break down our results into a language that people can understand, so that they know at the end of the day, these were the main points or main findings from my research. So we as the scientists need to really step up our game. For every article that we publish, we need to do two or three commentaries that the regular citizen can understand.
Esther, I can see scientists being worried about putting their work out in that way. I've definitely heard from scientists who are suspicious of the media. They've seen one media outlet or another maybe get their work wrong, or maybe less scrupulous people online misportray their work for various reasons. Is that something that you think might hold scientists back from doing this?
Yes, that's actually a big issue. But actually, the good news is that we have actually nowadays some media outlets that are really geared towards making sure that the scientist is happy with the entire article. The Conversation is one of a good outlet that actually is available for scientists and for really. And so what happens is a scientist says, this is my findings, and then they connect. The Conversation has editors that work with the scientist and they write the article, but the editor kind of just works with the scientist so that the article is really using language that the citizens can understand. However, the scientist is the end person who must approve. So they are technically, they must be happy with how the article is written. So yes, there are outlets that are finally, you know, getting it and saying yes. A lot of scientists don't want to publish their work because they are, you know, they are afraid that the results are going to be distorted, or the journalist is just going to put something that is not what the scientist meant to be. But yeah, with the Conversation, you actually work on your article and you make sure that you don't lose the meaning of your findings. So that's one way you can do that.
I can also see scientists saying, yeah, I've done my work. The data speaks for itself. I don't want to inject myself now into a political debate. That's for other people to take my work and see if it has political implications.
Yeah, but then at the end of the day, if you're passionate about your science, and say we spent sleepless nights working on this science, I think as a scientist, I want to see that, you know, finding of mine eventually being accepted out there. So yes, you know, some scientists may take that, yes, I've done my work, I've published it, now let everybody else take their work, you know, take my scientific findings, you know, above and beyond. But I think if you truly are in the science and you're there to see science impact today's challenges, then yes, I think that extra step, you can take that extra step. At the end of the day, yeah, then you are happy to know that your findings did not just go to a library, or they did not end up in just as one of those statistics of articles that were never read by anyone or didn't have impact. I think, you know, any passionate scientist would love to see their work finally end up translating into meaningful action, end up being appreciated by the person who is also funding our work. So yeah, I think, yeah, while they have a reason to say, yeah, I've done my work, but we need to take it further. And also, you know, right now with the debate and the, you know, public, let's say, you know, climate change, you've seen that people refusing to accept the fact. As a scientist, I sit back and I feel sad because I know that science that we've done clearly says so. And I wonder, what could I have done much more to make sure that people understand it and people actually appreciate the science? So.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Esther, are other people agreeing with you? Do you see more people in the science world wanting to have more clear communication with the public?
Oh, yes. I mean, look at most of actually the professional organization, for instance, Entomological Society of America. We have like science communication workshops during our meetings. We also have science policy fellowships where we are training some of our students to be able to share their work publicly. And we have like AAS, you know, so all the professional science-based organizations are finally rising up and they're finally pushing a lot of science communication. We have the, for example, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. They also pushed out a report where they are clearly saying to scientists, hey, we can do more. Let's be our own communicators of our own science. Let's push our work out to the public. So yes, we have, and even the universities too, they are clearly pushing our science outside. We have, you know, the departments are working with, for example, the journalists or journalists, you know, the deans have people who work on communication, and every time a good scientific article is out, then a story is written about it. So universities are changing, professional societies are changing, and scientific, you know, all the scientists are finally saying, hey, let's do more. What can we do more? So I see that change.
Esther, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Esther Gumby. She's a postdoctoral fellow at Auburn University. She joined us to talk about how scientists are changing the way they write about their work and trying to make it more accessible to the public. Paper company Kimberly-Clark announced late last month that it would close two plants in the Fox Valley. The closures would mean 600 lost jobs in that area. Since then, Governor Walker has called on Weedick to extend a tax deal to the paper company to stay in Wisconsin, and lawmakers are working on an incentive package. Paper has been a big part of the state's economy for a long time with deep roots in many parts of the state. Our next guest looked at the history of paper in Wisconsin in light of Kimberly-Clark's potential exit. Barry Adams covers regional and business news for the Wisconsin State Journal. Barry, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks, Rob.
Well, in your piece, you take us way back in paper history. This is an old industry in Wisconsin. Can you talk about some of its early roots?
Oh, the earliest roots, we believe, started in Milwaukee. And then once they started with rags, making paper out of rags. But then once the pulp process was developed in the 1870s, things really kind of took off. And that's when the Fox Valley really started to boom with papermaking. And many other Northwoods communities. You know, you got communities like Niagara, Wisconsin, Park Falls, Rhinelander, and then, of course, everyone along the Wisconsin River, many paper mills along there. Beloit even had, still does have a paper company, the Beloit Box Board Company. And, of course, Beloit was also known for its manufacturing of paper manufacturing equipment. So a lot of the paper mills, that equipment came from Beloit.
And all you really needed was access to trees and pulp and water, right? And that made for a pretty good plant location.
Right, which made the Fox River just a prime spot. You had the Northwoods nearby. You've got this water that's flowing out of Lake Winnebago into Green Bay. And paper mills, line up and down the Fox River Valley and, of course, the Wisconsin River as well.
And when I think, Barry, of paper, the image pops into my head of a stack of office printer paper or something you might write on. That's just a small part of what's coming out of a paper mill, right?
It is. Historically, commodity paper is what you would call that. But that's no longer the case for Wisconsin paper makers. A lot of that commodity paper is being made elsewhere. It's maybe being made overseas or down south or in Canada. In fact, the paper that I write for, that newsprint is not made in Wisconsin. So what's happening, though, with the paper industry in Wisconsin is that 90% of the paper products coming out of the mills here in Wisconsin are tissue-based or packaging. So think about Amazon. And think about when you go on Amazon and you order a product, what does it come in? Comes in a cardboard box. And those cardboard boxes have to come from somewhere. So packaging is a big thing. Thermal papers, when you get a receipt at the grocery store, that paper has to come from somewhere, and it's probably came from the Fox River Valley.
And in the medical profession, I hadn't thought, you know, when you go to the doctor's office, you might get that paper gown, or a lot of the staff might be wearing, I guess, a paper-based product.
Right. So you have products like that. You think about the, hygiene products and, the Depend diapers, the paper towels, those kind of things are all coming out of the valley. Particularly the Depends issue, being made at the Cold Spring plant there the Fox Valley there, just outside of Mena. I think caught some people by surprise because that plant, the employees were told, was profitable. And you think about the market for Depend diapers, a big market. That's a really new plant in terms of paper mills is concerned. It's a 26-year-old plant, so a pretty good, really in good shape. But I think a lot of people were caught off guard a little bit by the announcement by Kimberly Clark.
Talking to Barry Adams from the Wisconsin State Journal about the paper industry in Wisconsin, past and present. And Barry, this Kimberly Clark announcement, it's not a news story in a lot of ways. A lot of communities around the state have faced their local paper mill having major job cutbacks or closing completely, right?
Yeah, I've been covering this story off and on since 2008. I did a big look into the paper industry along the Wisconsin River back 10 years ago, and that's when Port Edwards closed its paper mill. And we saw Kimberly Clark that year close its paper mill as well, and a paper mill closed in Niagara. And, these are literal mill towns. And then in 2012, you look at Brokaw, a little town outside of Wausau. The reason that town existed was because of the paper mill. And, in fact, it's a really isolated little town because you come off the interstate and you cross the Wisconsin River and there's this huge paper mill and all these little houses. And that's all a product of the paper mill. And that closed in 2012. And now the village is in financial straits and there's talk of annexation into the city of Wausau. So, the history of the paper mills are strong in Wisconsin. It's still a major industry. As, in the late 90s, we had about 51,000 people employed in paper and pulp jobs in Wisconsin. That's now down to about 30,000, just over 30,000 jobs. We talked this past week about the loss of the jobs in the Fox River Valley, but the Wisconsin River Valley has seen tons of mills closed. The Flambeau River area, Park Falls, and Rhineland, and those mills have come back somewhat. There's been a lot of contraction, not just in the Fox Valley, but along the Wisconsin River Valley as well.
What has led to that contraction in paper mill jobs over the last couple of decades?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things to point to. I don't think there's any one issue that has resulted in this, and I think that's one of the difficult things. We're probably using less paper products of commodity grade type papers, thanks to the internet and things like that. And, we don't get as much mail as we used to, and we're not sending as many faxes as we used to, and everything's email, electronic. There's wage issues, there's environmental issues, there's tax issues, the overseas production of paper by China is huge, and it's tough to compete. And, these are global markets that we're talking about here. And we're also talking about paper companies that are no longer owned by Wisconsin companies. The Neenah Paper Company, founded in the 1870s in Neenah, that's no longer based in Neenah, Wisconsin. It's based in Georgia. And, so Kimberly Clark, another company, it was really interesting driving into Neenah and along East Wisconsin Avenue, and you see these huge homes that were from the founders of the Kimberly Clark Corporation. And just really grand, grand homes, and it reminds you of the past there. But Kimberly Clark is no longer based in Wisconsin; it's based in Dallas, Texas.
Barry Adams is with us to talk about the past and present of the paper industry in Wisconsin. He covers regional and business news for the Wisconsin State Journal. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you worked in the paper industry in Wisconsin yourself? Do you still? How has the paper industry influenced your local economy over time. Has your town been affected by the closure of a paper mill? And in the news today, should the state provide incentives for Kimberly-Clark to keep its plants open, the ones that were announced to be closed with 600 jobs or so at stake? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Barry Adams is with us from the Wisconsin State Journal, talking about the history of the paper industry in the state. This follows the announcement that paper company Kimberly-Clark would be closing two factories in the Fox Valley. Lawmakers are working on incentives to change Kimberly-Clark's minds on that. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should Wisconsin provide incentives to keep these factories open? And are you part of this story of paper manufacturing in Wisconsin? Did you grow up? Do you live in a mill town? Past or present, did a plant closure change your community? Have you worked there? Do you still work in that industry? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Barry, there's this debate going on now about what the state, if anything, should do to try to keep these plants open. Is this story of changes in the global paper industry bigger than anything the Wisconsin legislature can do to change their minds here?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know. There's a lot of issues that confront the paper industry. Is this enough to entice them to keep it open? I don't know. That's a question that we're all waiting on.
Now, you mentioned earlier that we're down about 20-plus thousand jobs in the paper industry in the state, but you said there were some places that had bounced back, some places that had seen rebounds. What kind of stories are going on there?
Some of the paper facilities in the Neenah area, Fox Crossing, have been reused for other paper-type products. So we're seeing reuse of some of these properties. I think it was, if I'm remembering correctly, I think it was the mill in Rhinelander was going to close, and I thought the employees did something like that, or maybe it was Park Falls. It was one of the two. There are cases where if you can find independent ownership, you have a lot more control that way. One of the striking things to see up in the Fox Valley, though, is when you go into Kimberly. That Kimberly paper mill has been there since the 1800s. And it's almost torn down completely now, and it closed back in 2008, and put 600 people out of work, and now that's being redeveloped into a housing development right along the Fox River there. So obviously it's not producing jobs on that property, but it's being redeveloped into housing and into a commercial district. But that's an example of some of the reuse that's happening.
And Barry, when we hear about the changing manufacturing industry, another story we hear a lot is automation and mechanization, where, even if that plant stays open or reopens or a new plant opens, it's not going to provide that a massive base of jobs. It's going to provide fewer but higher skilled jobs. Is that happening also in the paper industry?
Yeah, I think so. I didn't get too much into that in this story. But I think, like with any industry, you're going to have automation. You think back 100 years, what did it take to get a log into a pulping machine? Maybe you needed 10 people to do that job, and now today you only need one guy running a machine to pull that log into a pulp facility. So, I think the paper industry is just like any other industry. These huge paper machines can be 100, they can be 200 feet long, and you maybe only have a few people really running,
We got an email from Kirsta in Green Bay who writes, "I'm a millennial who grew up in the Fox Cities, and I'm one of the many, many Kimberly-Clark kids. There were a good percentage of kids in my school in Appleton. Many of our parents are or were employees of Kimberly-Clark. It's a huge part of the Fox Cities economy. This is going to be a big loss. It's also," Kirsta says, "way too late for the state government to do anything about the closings." Thanks for that email. Can you talk about, Barry, the impact on the Fox Cities area of these planned closures and other recent closings?
Yeah, it's a cultural change, too. It's not just an employment change, but it's a whole cultural shift. You're losing jobs. Lives are changing. And it's a shock to the community. And, you drive around, and as you drive into Kimberly, from Appleton, as you cross into Kimberley, you kind of look around these small houses that are there, and you know, 90% of those homes are probably built with paper money, you know. So everybody has a connection to the paper industry in some way or another up there. It's like it'd be pretty unusual to find to walk up to somebody on the street and say, "Hey, do you know somebody, or are you related to anybody in the paper industry?" And 9 chances out of 10, that person is going to say yes.
And you, as a little sidebar to this story, you visited a paper history museum in the area. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the Paper Discovery Center, and it's also the home of the International Paper Hall of Fame. It's located in the old Atlas Paper Company Mill, which is started by some of the founders of Kimberly-Clark and some investors in Minnesota. It's a wonderful place. And really, walking into there, you get a real sense for what an old paper facility used to look like. Of course, all the machines are gone. And now they've got interactive displays, and kindergartners can come in there and make paper, and they have a lab, and they've got a wonderful archive that stores items from the past, a library on the lower level, and it's always going to be there, and it's going to be something that'll always keep alive the history of the paper industry in the Fox Valley.
So is this an area, though, in the Fox Valley where there's another economy? There are other options. This isn't the only game in town like it might have been in a smaller community like you were talking about Brokaw earlier.
Right. You know, I think that's one of the advantages for the Valley. I mean, you think about the Valley. I mean, the Fox Valley that's the heart of manufacturing, really, in Wisconsin. You know, Milwaukee's got this manufacturing, you know, Racine and Kenosha to some extent, but when you really think about the heart of manufacturing in Wisconsin, you got to think about the Fox Valley, from Green Bay all the way down to Fond du Lac. Think about the businesses that are there with Oshkosh Truck and Pierce Truck, and you know what they're making along that corridor. You drive to a Packers game, just think about all the companies that are along that corridor, and you know they're trying to diversify, and they are diversifying, and they're trying to move forward in a new economy. I think the paper industry is always going to be a part of the Fox Valley. The question is just how big of a part is that industry going to be for those communities?
And Barry, we see state lawmakers, as we said, trying to get an incentive package to keep these factories open, these plants open. Have we seen similar efforts when other paper product companies have closed around the state?
I'm not really sure. I don't think I can answer that question, Rob. You know, I think local governments have come in and tried to help things out. I'm not sure what the level of state help has been on some of the projects. I'm sure there has been some sort of efforts, but you know, it's a tough thing, and it'll be interesting to see how this proposal from and how if the Senate will take up this bill that the Assembly passed.
We'll leave it there, Barry. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thanks, Rob.
That's Barry Adams. He covers regional and business news at the Wisconsin State Journal. He joined us to talk about the history of the paper industry in Wisconsin and the present and future, and how lawmakers are trying to convince paper company Kimberly-Clark to change plans that would close a couple of factories in the state with something on the order of 600 jobs at stake. You can learn more about the Kimberly-Clark deal in the state legislature tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show.